Okay, we are live. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On today's show, I have a very special guest. He just published a book. His name is Philip Eil. Last name is spelled E-I-L. And the full title of the book, if you're watching this on YouTube, X, or Rockfin, you can see this. Full title is Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became the, quote, pill mill killer, unquote. And he has a blurb there by Harold Schechter, who when I worked for Ed, I signed him up for an interview too. So this is very famous. He's got great book blurbs and great reviews. I think it just got published last week. He already has 7 5-star reviews on there. And the book is available on audiobook. It's on audio CD, which I don't see often, and Kindle and hardcover. So you can check it out in different formats. Yeah, it just came out April 9th, but very important book and a lot of kind of malfeasance in the medical community. But it goes in detail about a guy by the name of Paul Volkman, and he can talk more in detail about that. So, Philip Eil, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, William.
Excellent. So, for people who may not have heard your name, I think this is your first book. Maybe you can talk a little bit about your background. I mean, you are an award-winning freelance journalist based in Providence, Rhode Island. You're the former news editor of the alt-weekly newspaper, the Providence Phoenix. And you've contributed to The Atlantic, The Nation, Men's Health, Boston Globe, Huffington Post, and the Columbia Journalism Review. And you have an MFA in nonfiction writing and from the Columbia University School of the Arts. So maybe you can talk a little bit more in addition to your CV.
Sure. So I have been a journalist. I'm calling in now from Providence, Rhode Island, which is my hometown. That is not Long Island. Some people from other parts of the country get it confused. We're about an hour south of Boston. And this is where I grew up, and this is where I have done a lot of my journalism. I moved back here after graduate school in 2011 and hit the ground running and started writing, resuming writing for my local alt-weekly newspaper, where I had been a contributor since a couple years after college. Really picked up a lot of steam, writing about all kinds of things around the state, arts, culture, media, you name it, politics eventually. Eventually made my way to becoming the news editor that Alt Weekly, which unfortunately, like so many of these weekly papers, closed down. And since then, I've really had kind of an eclectic career as a freelancer. I've written a lot about mental health. I've written a lot about the Freedom of Information Act, which is the Freedom of Information Act is part of the backstory to this book, because it involved a years-long battle against the Drug Enforcement Administration for thousands of pages of evidence shown during Volkman's trial. I have continued to write about Rhode Island. I find this place perpetually fascinating and entertaining and sometimes frustrating. I write about local politics here. This book has really been on the front burner, the back burner for most of my journalism career. It was within a year of me kind of getting bitten by the journalism bug shortly after college that I learned that a guy my dad had gone to college and medical school with, but had fallen out of touch with in the mid-70s, had been indicted and charged with this massive, really horrifying set of alleged crimes in Southern Ohio. Prosecutors said that Paul Volkman, for about a 3-year period, in Southern Ohio, right on the Ohio River, which means just across the river from Kentucky and a little bit west of West Virginia. They call it the tri-state area down there. Prosecutors said he had been basically dealing drugs out of these cash-only, non-hospital-affiliated pain clinics, which I would come to learn were really a serial problem down there. Paul Volkman was, as it turns out, not the first doctor to get charged with drug dealing crimes and hauled off to prison from that area, nor was he the last. And prosecutors said that this had been a scheme running for multiple years, that he was dispensing hundreds of thousands of pills, opiate painkillers, sedatives, muscle relaxers, and that a number of his patients died as a result. So initially, when I first heard about this, I was 23, 24 years old, and I knew little more than these two basic facts, that this guy and my dad had gotten these really impressive credentials, MD, PhDs from the University of Chicago, and that some 30 years later, the federal government had pointed the finger at Paul Volcker and said, you're a drug dealer and a lethal one. And so it was a mystery to me. I wanted to know what on earth happened to this guy. My dad could not account for what had happened in the years, the decades after they had parted ways after medical school. So I had this personal connection to the story, but also this major question of what the heck happened to Paul Volcker. And so it took me a long time. There have been a lot of stops, starts, delays, detours in the process of writing this book. But some 15 years after hearing that initial story and really, you know, getting fascinated, I finally have this book out in the world.
And it's very well researched. Maybe you can go into that because you spent a lot of time talking to first person people who knew Volcker. And Volcker himself is kind of an enigmatic, like your dad and him seem to have divulged different careers. And he was obviously a brilliant guy, right? To have a double doctorate. But he, I mean, maybe you can talk more about him and kind of, he changed different like areas within the medicine over time too, right?
Yes. Volcker is quite an interesting and unusual guy. And that was what initially drew me into the story. You don't hear too often of guys with his kind of background, MD, PhD, University of Chicago, high school valedictorian, getting accused of federal crimes and eventually thrown in prison for four consecutive life terms. That, by the way, William, is one of the other things that makes this case stick out, is that there have been dozens of doctors charged with and convicted of crimes in the opiate epidemic, crimes related to opiates. But none of them, as far as I can tell, and I've looked pretty hard, have sentences that match or exceed that four consecutive life terms. But anyway, shortly after I learned about the story after Volkman's indictment and a few years before he went to trial. There was about a 4-year window of time there. And I was about to enter a graduate writing program. And I did what you do as a journalist, which is reach out to the main player and see if they're going to talk to you. It's hard to say now whether I would have kept going with this project had Volcker not agreed to speak with me, which is not to say this is simply his authorized version of the story. It's far from that. But the fact that he did pretty quickly respond to my letter and agree to speak to me meant, okay, it's showtime. Let's roll with this story and see where it goes. And so during the Christmas break of my first semester of graduate school in late 2009, I was in New York. I drove out to Chicago and really spent a couple days with him, multiple hours over 2 days, and then returned the following summer for more in-person interviews. I asked if I could record these interviews. I explained who I was, that I was a journalist. He agreed and told me his version of what had happened in his life and in his career and in this window of time that the government said he was a drug dealer. And later on, after his conviction, we would continue to correspond both for the year or so he was in a county jail awaiting his sentencing and then via email when he was in federal prison. So all told, I spoke with this guy for pretty much a decade. And I have no shortage of his side of the story. From those initial interviews, from letters, from emails. But as I found, and by the way, in his version of the story, he's an innocent man, wrongfully charged, and then once convicted, wrongfully convicted. He says that he was acting by the book, that all of his prescriptions were legal, proper, appropriate, and in fact, that he was an empathetic guy who was ministering to these patients who were in a lot of pain, chronic pain, and had been kind of cast off by the world of established medicine and unable to get the care they needed from procedures, from other kinds of treatment, and were left seeking the kind of help he was offering. So at no point in the decade or so or more that I spoke with him did he ever admit any kind of guilt, nor does he do that now. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, his case did go to a trial. In a lot of cases, when the federal government charges someone with a crime, the federal government is a formidable opponent.
They never lose. I think their success rate in trial is like 99%.
Exactly. Exactly. The success rate for federal conviction is well over 90%, or at least it's way up there. They don't lose. And most people take a plea deal because that's the one way you have to potentially get a lesser sentence. Volkman, who is a definitely an angry guy, a defiant guy, you could certainly call him a belligerent guy, refused at any point to accept guilt. And as part of that said, no, I want to take this to a trial. And so there was this 8-week trial over in federal court in Cincinnati, which was a couple hours west of the area where his crimes took place. And as a result, there was a 4,000-page trial transcript that I made use of, and there were thousands of pages of evidence. So I had a lot. Oh, so, and in addition to that, I certainly went to Southern Ohio many times, and over the course of the years I worked on this, interviewed anyone and everyone who had a perspective on this guy and his career. So that were his two children, that were former classmates, including my dad, even though most of them, their memories were limited to, you know, the 60s and 70s. That was people who knew Volkman in his pre-pain clinic career. As you said, he had a lot of different kind of chapters in his career, started in medical research, went into pediatrics, was doing pediatrics and emergency medicine to help pay the bills on the side, continued to do emergency medicine in Chicago where he lived, but also started traveling around the Midwest as a kind of temporary fill-in emergency room doctor. So he wore a lot of different hats, and I spoke to as many people as possible from the earlier parts of his career. And I also went down to Ohio, Southern Ohio, and spoke with as many people down there as I could who either had personal connections to the case or were just simply part of this community that was really ravaged by prescription drugs.
And can you kind of talk, you kind of had a checkered career even before he made it to the pain clinic, I think in 2003.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? He still was kind of in kind of denial or not accepting responsibility even before the pain clinic. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's right. One of the things that I think is essential to understanding Volkman's claims of innocence and the fact that he claims to be an innocent and earnest and empathetic pain doctor, is that he didn't go into chronic pain as a specialty by choice. He went in really out of professional necessity, you might even say desperation, because at this point, after a couple decades in pediatrics and in emergency medicine, he was unable to obtain malpractice insurance. And that was a result of a handful of malpractice cases filed against him over the years. A couple were from his practice as a pediatrician, and a couple were from his time as a traveling emergency room doctor. And two of those cases went to jury trials and verdicts against him. Two more resulted in settlements against him by insurance companies. Another one, which actually didn't gain any traction, but was kind of deflected because he filed for bankruptcy, stemmed from his pediatrics years. So there were a lot of malpractice cases for me to dig into. Once again, he not only does he claim his innocence from the criminal charges, he claims that these were all bogus cases, frivolous lawsuits filed by predatory lawyers, and that he was screwed over. And so which is not entirely unheard of from doctors who have faced malpractice cases. Certainly among doctors, they don't love malpractice lawyers. So, you know, it was plausible that he might have, faced some frivolous lawsuits. So I did my best to look into those as well. So I got more documents from those cases. I interviewed lawyers and plaintiffs and all kinds of other people. The book really wound up being kind of one long fact-checking process where I tell my readers what Volkman says about a particular time in his life or career, and I do my best to see if there's any truth to it by tracking down other people, tracking down documents, and so on. So you'll see me in the book go back and forth, and what you'll see and what I found is a lot of patterns emerge. This is a guy who was often self-aggrandizing, quick to claim victim status, plays pretty fast and loose with the truth. And so I had my work cut out for me as a journalist and a fact checker.
And he didn't seem to make some of the best judgmental decisions as a doctor, like some very questionable things, which is why he got it. And I think I remember in the first part of your book, you talked to somebody, they said the amount of malpractice suits, he had an inordinately large amount, or more so than something. And I think he ended up declaring bankruptcy with a really big, I was surprised to see how much money he had to write
off. As I'm talking about this book in bookstores and interviews, I find myself going back to how long it took to write the book, 15 years. And I wasn't working on it every day. I was doing other things and also making a name for myself as a journalist. But one of the many reasons it took so long was there were a lot of really complex subjects that I, neither doctor nor lawyer, needed to, you know, learn up on so I could feel comfortable writing about them. And one of them, I mean, even before we get to this being a crime story, it's a malpractice story. And so I felt I really needed to not just study the facts of these cases and see what sense I could make of them, but I also, as you said, reached out to a couple experts who study malpractice law, who have written books on it, and asked them, hey, how normal is it for a guy like this to be sued, to have four cases, two which go to trial and two which are settled? How plausible is it that this guy is in fact a victim of, as he says, an out of control malpractice system? And what they told me was it's in fact very unlikely, and that basically lightning doesn't strike in the same place four times in this kind of a way, despite what he said. So that was one of many areas where I mean, that's what you do as a journalist. It's a wonderful excuse to get on the phone and call up experts and ask them about the stuff they know the most about.
Right. And he was can you define what a locum tenens physician is? It seems like he didn't mind or wanted to get out of the house or do something.
Sure. So Volkman really lived in Chicago. He grew up on the East Coast, but he moved to Chicago for medical school, and he stayed there for pretty much his entire adult life, including, I should note, even the period of alleged criminal activity 400 miles away in southern Ohio. He was commuting there on a weekly basis, flying from Chicago, where he lived in a very posh apartment on Lakeshore Drive. In 2006 or seven, the rent was $4,500 a month. This is a building, you know, in a pretty glitzy part of Chicago with a doorman and all kinds of amenities. So he was flying there and driving the couple hours down to this small town. So he started his career in pediatrics there and in local emergency rooms, but he found that he could make somewhat counterintuitively more money by taking short-term temporary emergency room gigs. Locum tenens, the term you asked about, which I didn't know about before this, is really a fancy name for a temp worker for doctors. It stands for basically Latin for a person's taking another person's place. So ultimately, he found, because of laws of supply and demand, he could make more money as a doctor in lesser populated places with a lower supply of doctors in small towns in Ohio and Indiana and Wisconsin and Kentucky. I think he ultimately had medical licenses in six different states, and over the years worked in dozens of different hospitals. And some of those places were where he faced these malpractice lawsuits.
Right. So he's kind of moving around, wearing different hats. He had kind of an interesting thing. And like his movement into, I think he wrote in the pediatrics, like he wasn't really considered a warm and fuzzy people person either, more of an academic You've mentioned the word nebbish, kind of maybe. So you kind of like moved in places, maybe out of character, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I did was, in addition to interviewing my dad about what he could remember about this guy, was tracking down as many of their old classmates as possible to see, you know, did anyone see this coming? The short answer is no. Nobody from medical school said, you know, they remembered this guy being a huge walking red flag. Nobody told me, oh yeah, we all thought this guy was going to wind up in prison. In fact, one of his old roommates from medical school, who himself wasn't a med student, was so impressed with Paul that he said he thought he was going to open the paper one day and see that Paul had been given the Nobel Prize for medicine. That, of course, didn't happen. Among the things they told me, even if they didn't say this guy is for sure a criminal, there were still kind of, I think, seeds of personality traits that would later really bloom. Those folks who knew him back in his medical training said he was quite bright, but he was also a little bit arrogant, a bit of a misanthrope, that he didn't pay much attention to his appearance. He was a bit socially awkward. They didn't think of him as dating much. One guy said he wasn't the kind of guy you would want to get a beer with. So when out of medical school, he went into pediatrics. That was one of many professional decisions that people told me struck them as a little bit odd. It didn't make financial sense because pediatrics is, you know, near the bottom in terms of how various medical specialties pay. And it also didn't make much interpersonal sense because he didn't strike his classmates as somebody, you know, who had the temperament to be a pediatrician.
So he decides he needs a job. He's desperate. He's left his last job. He finds this job in Portsmouth, but yeah. He goes into that job. He wasn't going into like a sterile vacuum. There was a lot going on around that area at the time. Maybe you could give a little background about the topology and like the other doctors that are around that area.
Sure. So what initially drew me to this story was the story of this guy, Paul Volkman. What I didn't know going in, but what I soon learned was it would very much become a story about the place where his crimes occurred. And that was a place where I hadn't been to. I hadn't even really thought about it or heard about it. It's this part of Southern Ohio, and I say in the book that if you're picturing Ohio as flat and Midwestern, that may be part of the state, but there are parts of Ohio down in the southeastern part that are really hilly and almost Southern in their culture. This is the Appalachian part of Ohio, and that's where Volkman's crimes took place. This is about 2 hours due south of Columbus, right on the Ohio River. And this is a part of the country that's undergone some really serious poverty in recent decades. It isn't just Appalachia. This is a part of the country in the state of Ohio where I describe it as where the Rust Belt and Appalachia overlap. So this town of Portsmouth used to be a major manufacturing hub. They made bricks there. They made shoes there. They made steel there. And in the early 20th century, it was a really bustling place. But as is the case with so many towns, former manufacturing towns, that all kind of dried up over time. And by the time Paul Volkman arrived in 2003, the region was beset by a number of social problems, including poverty, but also it was one of the earliest places hit by the opiate epidemic, particularly these kind of sketchy, cash-only, high-volume prescribing pain clinics, known to some around there as pill mills. And so even by the time, and some were in Southern Ohio, some were just across the river in Kentucky. And by the time, one really telling detail, you know, I spent a lot of time in Portsmouth and I spent time in the local library, in the local history room, combing through old newspaper clippings. And I found one article from the year he arrived. It was about a mayoral race, and the two mayoral candidates in the town where Volkman's crimes took place were arguing over whether the city deserved the nickname the OxyContin capital of the world. So even the fact that that debate was happening then shows you the kind of environment he was walking into, and where he would begin to prescribe really enormous amounts of opiates.
Yeah, so it's coming out of there, but there's a bunch of different characters, and you write about this guy, Richard Gritzmacher. He was there for 5 days, and then he already was out. So some people adapted to the environment, and some people seemed like they just saw what was happening and ran for it. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, so one of the wilder parts of this story is there's this kind of odd couple partnership at the heart of the majority of Volkman's time. He was down there doing this pill mill activity for nearly 3 years. And for more than 2 years, he was working for a woman named Denise Huffman, who I suppose you could call an entrepreneur, didn't have any medical background, didn't have a college degree, had worked in fast food places and local factories. And I really had trouble kind of drawing up her backstory. It was pretty murky by her own description. But she had started a cash-only pain clinic a couple years before Volkman's arrival. Her main qualification, she said, was that she and her husband were chronic pain patients themselves and had found it hard to get the kind of care they needed. Others suggested that she was very closely acquainted with some of these other characters who had been up and running in this business. And when some of them were taken down by law enforcement, just kind of picked up the reins and ran with it. But as you said, the doctor you mentioned, there were a few doctors who preceded Volkman in being employed at this clinic, one of whom, who I think like Volkman answered an ad online for a locum tenens gig. The ad had apparently said this is some kind of general medical clinic, but when he got there, found that it was what he saw as basically just a pill mill. And he was so alarmed that he wrote a note. This was when the clinic was across the river in Kentucky. He wrote a note to the state medical board, basically a whistleblowing letter, and said, you guys need to come check this place out. And needless to say, his time working there didn't last very long. But ultimately, and there were a couple other doctors who didn't work out there. But when Volkman arrived, apparently it passed his test, his standards. He said it went down. He went down there. It seemed legit. He said initially, at least, that he trusted and believed in Denise, even though they had a bitter split later on. And Denise and her daughter, who also worked at the clinic, wound up being charged with Volkman, and she and her daughter pleaded guilty and testified at his trial. That partnership didn't work out in the long run.
Did they serve any time? Did Huffman and her daughter serve any time?
Oh, yeah. The daughter, who was more of an office manager helping with the logistics of the clinic, served about 5 years. And Denise, who was the founder of the clinic, served about 10 years.
Do you know what their yearly revenues were kind of at the height of the pill mill factory, happening?
So the DEA at one point estimated that between the fees for the cash only, the visit fees to see the clinic had two main sources of revenue. One was payments to see the doctor, and another was for the on-site pharmacy, which I need to explain a little bit. Within a couple weeks, maybe even earlier, of Volkman arriving at this clinic, local pharmacies in really a pretty large area were so alarmed by the prescriptions he was writing, again, for opiates, for muscle relaxers, for sedatives, and found the clientele that they were serving to be so kind of sketchy and not credible as chronic pain patients, that one by one, these pharmacies, many of which were later called, pharmacists were later called to testify at the trial, refused to fill the scripts. So this presented the clinic with an issue of what to do if their main, really their main business was prescribing medication and local pharmacies balked at the scripts. They did what was legal at the time in Ohio, albeit there were supposed to be tight restrictions. They applied to the state pharmacy board for an on-site dispensary license. And were given the green light. And as I said, they were supposed to run a very tight ship of very diligent record keeping, and Volkman, the on-site doctor, keeping an eye on every pill that went out the door. That didn't happen. But they had this pharmacy, this on-site pharmacy that they established within a few months of Volkman arriving there. So between the payments for the visits to the doctor and the revenues from the on-site pharmacy, the DEA estimated that this clinic made multiple million dollars over the course of a few years. So it was would have been a lucrative business anywhere, but certainly in this really down and out part of Ohio, where the main businesses had left a long time ago, it was even more, it stuck out even more.
Right. So there's definitely a financial, did they have like some kind of incentive system for him or anything like that, where he got paid for each prescription? I'm not really aware.
They didn't. They didn't. And one of the things Volkman said, pointed to in his own defense, was that he claimed he didn't make any money from this activity, which isn't true. I mean, he was getting a handsome salary of $4,500 every week, which was up to $5,000, or maybe it was $5,000 to $5,500. So he was getting paid quite well. There were the kind of bonuses for prescribing that you asked about at other clinics around there at that time. Some of his predecessors went to trial, and at the trial, the clinic owner explained, yeah, I hired this doctor and told him you'll make more money if you prescribe more. I don't think Volkman needed that kind of bonus to keep going, because his back was really against the wall professionally. When he became uninsurable, he said himself that he really found himself unable to get any kind of medical job. And he had a pretty upscale life in Chicago that he was intent on maintaining. And he explained to me that before he found this job, for some period of time, I wish he told me more, he was chopping vegetables in a restaurant kitchen, which for a guy with an MD, PhD, who has a very high opinion of himself, I can only imagine the humiliation and anger that went with that. So he was really eager for any kind of job. And I think just that keeping the paychecks coming in was quite enough of an incentive for him.
Yeah, he had a lot of overhead. He definitely did. And how do you think that he went into that job knowing that he was going to do whatever it takes to fulfill whatever? Or do you think that he kind of slid into criminality? What's your take on that?
It's hard to know, because Volkman himself says he never became a criminal. He claims it was all medicine. He claims that he's still an innocent guy. And I mean, you won't find him really taking responsibility for any mistakes throughout his entire career. So it's hard to, I mean, to the extent that I could, I tried to dig around in his head a bit and see what his thinking was like and how his psychology and personality worked. I mean, I stopped short of offering any kind of diagnosis on him for various reasons. Among them, I think, as a storyteller and as a journalist, I think it's more effective to just show what he does and what he says. I do know that he studied up on the state level laws pertaining to this kind of medicine and prescribing opiates. There was something called the Ohio Intractable Pain Act that was designed to an extent, protect doctors and allow them to feel comfortable prescribing opiates without fear of sanction or prosecution. And that was part of a broader context in the state and in society in general in the 90s and 2000s of, hey, we ought to treat pain more aggressively than we've been treating it, and a lot of pain is going undertreated and so on. I know that Volkman felt that he was following that law. I'm not sure if he actually was. And because he was following that law, that the DEA had no right to come in and investigate him in the way they did. So
He was charged. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Just make of that what you will. He still swears that he was following the appropriate state law.
Gotcha. And do you think, like, I think he was charged with like 15 deaths, or he was found guilty of 15. Do you think that there were more? Like, what do you think the real impact of harm was coming through Tri-State Healthcare and Volkmann while he was there?
So the highest estimate that I heard for the number of deaths he could have caused, and this was, again, one of the areas in the book, like many, where there weren't necessarily hard numbers to say, these are how many deaths he caused. Pretty much everything was under dispute by different parties in this case, right down to the fact of whether he was a doctor or a drug dealer. And certainly the deaths were a big part of that. I heard estimates as high as in the mid-30s for how many deaths among his patients that law enforcement looked into. They didn't wind up charging him with a connection to that many deaths, nor did they ever in fact charge him with murder or manslaughter. They charged him with federal drug dealing counts with death or injury resulting. And they charged him, I believe, with drug dealing with death or injury resulting to 14 patients. And of those 14, he was found guilty of dealing drugs to the majority of them. And the jury had an option ultimately to hold him directly responsible if they felt the evidence merited it for the deaths of patients. And they chose to do that in 4 cases. So he was, at the end of the day, found legally directly responsible for 4 patient deaths, although he was found responsible for dealing drugs illegally to more patients than that. And it's from those 4 deaths that we get the 4 consecutive life terms that he's serving.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's really a severe penalty. I mean, they really got him. We are at the 36-minute mark, Philip. Do you have time for a few questions?
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. Joker asks, I'm curious if they were involved with any rehabs or halfway houses. Do you know of any connection or anything like that in that area?
Well, there's certainly a lot of rehabilitation clinics now. I went down to Southern Ohio starting in 2010, which was, again, in that window between Volkmann's indictment and trial starting. And when I first went down there, the addiction problem was really raging out of control in Scioto County, the county where most of his alleged crimes took place. A few months before I arrived, the county health commissioner had declared a state of emergency due to the number of overdose deaths. And when I got there, there were something like 7, 8, 9 non-hospital affiliated pain clinics for this county of 80,000. And eventually, for a lot of different reasons, including laws passed at the state level, those clinics were shut down. And now rehabilitation clinics and the rehabilitation industry is ironically perhaps one of the biggest employers in this part of the state now, which is nice to see. And there is a large demand to be met. Right. But Volkmann, as far as I know, in my conversations with him and in his overall actions, really didn't seem to take the risk of addiction very seriously. And I don't know of any time where I didn't see much evidence of him referring people for addiction care. He was much more interested in just cutting them loose as patients rather than directing them toward rehab.
Interesting. Richard asks, how difficult was the FOIA process? And can you elaborate on the withholding of documents? Thank you.
Very difficult. It took me almost 6 years from the date of my first FOIA request to the date of the last ruling in my ultimate lawsuit for this thing to be finally settled. For what I thought was a pretty simple question, I wasn't asking for privileged investigative documents. I wasn't asking for private documents. I only wanted to see the evidence that had been shown to the jury during Volkmann's trial, which was an open court proceeding. And these documents, as far as I could tell, were never placed under any special seal. However, I think because this case involved medical records, which in any other context than a criminal trial would be private, and for good reason. I'm even though I'm a transparency advocate as a journalist, I'm not out here saying, you know, your medical records or my medical records should automatically be public. Hardly. However, the equation changes when those records and other evidence are used in a criminal proceeding that sends a guy to prison for four consecutive life terms. I think there are real concerns about transparency there. And so that, I mean, aside from the overall dysfunction of the Freedom of Information Act system, it is not necessarily famous for working well or quickly. I think that added complicating factor of medical privacy really was one of the many reasons that this case, the FOIA case, wound up being as tricky and combative as it was, and why I ultimately needed to ask the local ACLU here in Rhode Island for help getting me lawyers so we could sue the DEA to release more than really just the handful of documents they had released up to that point.
Interesting. Fascinating. And then Tolkien asks, because didn't the same doctors prescribe pain meds and Suboxone and methadone? Do you know anything about that?
So I do know that the quality of the rehabilitation services down there varied, and that in some cases I would hear stories about sketchy pain clinics being replaced a few years down the road by sketchy Suboxone clinics. You know, clinics offering medication-assisted treatment. That is not me saying that I don't approve of medication-assisted treatment or anything like that, or rehab in general. I think that stuff can be great, but I do think, you know, there were big markets down there initially for pain pills and then for rehabilitation services after that. And I think I did meet some folks in the local rehab community who were wonderful people doing everything above board and really well, but I would hear stories about some sketchier actors involved in that.
Gotcha. And I mean, we're at the 41 minute mark. Is there anything you'd like to add? There's a lot more to the book, right? There's the criminal trial, tons of yeah. documents. Can you maybe talk about what else people can find and where they can find prescription for pain?
Well, they can find the book wherever books are sold, at their local independent bookstore or online, Amazon, bookshop.org, Barnes & Noble. They can, if they're audio readers, listeners, they can find it on Audible. If they're e-readers, they can find it wherever they get their e-books. I would say a couple things that I would want to add. One, there were a number of reasons why I found this case so fascinating, even beyond my initial curiosity. One was that fact that although there were a lot of doctors charged with prescription drug dealing, there were the number of doctors who went to trial is far lower. And that really made this an amazing opportunity to look at that trial transcript, appear inside the courtroom for those 8 weeks, and to offer a kind of legal case study for my readers. It was really interesting to me to read the transcripts and to see the lawyers on either side, how they chose to argue their cases. I mean, it's like the kind of courtroom drama you see on TV or in movies, but it's real life. The other thing I would add is that really what I tried to keep at the center of this book, wherever possible, was the lives of the people who went to Volkmann's clinics that were lost. There were about 13 people who died tragic, untimely deaths, who were listed in the indictment, whose family members believed that this doctor and this clinic owner were to blame. And I really wanted to avoid some of the worst impulses of the true crime genre in dealing with these folks. I didn't want them to just be two-dimensional characters. I wanted to really describe them in their full humanity where I could, you know, what they liked to do with their free time, what they did for a living, what they were like with their family members. So yet another reason why it took me so long, for good reason, to finish this book, was because I really wanted to get those stories right and to honor the memories of these folks. So that was a real responsibility for me, and it was also a privilege to tell stories, the stories of these folks who were no longer around to tell their own story.
Yeah, it's very important. I'm glad you took that time. It's like you said, an oversight at times in the true crime community. Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad you focused on that. And again, the full title of the book is Prescription for Pain, How a Once Promising Doctor Became a, quote, pill mill killer, unquote. Author again is Philip Eil, last name spelled E-I-L. I'll put a link to his website. Again, you can see the website if you're watching this. It's his full name, philipeil.com. You can see the book here. And is that the best place to contact you if anybody wants to interview you? Or
Yes. I mean, they can find me via my website, which has my email. And I was already on a lot of social media sites before the book, but I feel like I signed up for all of them now. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter X. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on TikTok. I'm on Instagram. So if they can also contact me via pretty much any one of those sites as well.
Awesome. Again,
and I would add that if they're in Ohio, I'm going to be doing a number of bookstore events in Ohio coming up in May. I'm going to be in Columbus. I'm going to be in Cincinnati, the Toledo area, Cleveland. It was really important for me because this was an Ohio-based story to try to take this story to as many readers there as I can. So if they're in Ohio and listening, I would love to see them at one of those events.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah, people get out and check it out. Again, the title again is Prescription for Pain, and the author is Philip Eil, just published April 9th, 2024. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Stay there.